semiconductor suit?
Yeah.
I imagine I got Janssen's books, too.
They never returned them,
huh? I don't have them.
Wow. Maybe they're still in the litigation?
Hey, I don't need them. I've got 14 boxes of books.
Again.
Wow. I'd like to talk about the spirit in those days. This may sound corny, but let me say it anyway. It's probably my turn after 20 years to thank the people in this room for the support. But it was never a situation where it was a we and they. They being what manufacturing, you know, the guys who put out the grunts and the hardware. It was always engineering, design engineering, software support, and the grunts on the floor putting out machines. And although I exaggerated the point up front saying that every machine went out with an engineer, of course that was in the early systems, but as we went along,
ran out of engineers.
There was always support there, and I, after 20 years, I just want to say thank you.
I thought Andy Knowles was pretty good at that in terms of that that outing we used to have in the dinner room.
Once a month,
was it
once a month, everybody had to go out to the plant.
Yeah. Once a month, the his staff, whether you liked it or not.
If you didn't like the trip, too bad.
And he used to have his staff meetings out there once a month. Yeah. So,
right, that was the other
which
thing.
Was
we got marketing folks and the salespeople with manufacturing. Yeah. In fact, we started to set up customer visits. That was one of the first things. I mean, I started working with the company well before that, and I believe, and I maybe took the horn here for the 11 group, but I believe the PDP-11 was the first. We were producing eights, you know, at one a day, and that was a big deal. But we started producing PDP-11s. A whole different atmosphere around team spirit and the fact that we're trying to get the customer closer to what we were doing. So that's my input.
It's coming back.
In fact, he supported, he had a red phone and Barry Weeks had a red phone. To support him, it was literally a red phone was bought and it had to be manned 24 hours a day in case the guys from manufacturing or the field, I would ignore the field, but if manufacturing called, it either rang in his desk or at his home. He had a red phone at his home, too. And they were literally the war phones like Uncle Sam was using.
Who had those?
Huh?
Who had those?
Barry Weeks, because he and I were running support engineering after we started going. And Jim and the guys went off to do the second machine.
Is that kind of support significantly changed today or non-existent? Or just?
It's changed quite a bit. I must say, probably depending on the PBU, but Jesse Lipgren, who manages the Mayfair group, certainly has taken up where Andy Knowles started. As far as the, not speaking to Tom here, but as far as engineering, it's rather difficult to get engineering to come out to the manufacturing plant these days. It is, but in the 11 days...
Some PBUs today have made a valiant attempt in these 4x4, 5x5, 6x6, 7x7 teams to try to do it. But see, they abstracted it once. The 4x4s and 5x5s are all the bosses of the people who should really be meeting. But then, to be fair, it's just much harder to do.
It's a totally different system nowadays. I mean, I remember going through some of the old documents that I had laying around from those days, and I had the complete schedule for my program. I mean, a whole schedule from beginning to end was one piece of paper. And because I was a hardcore hippie back then, I used to, there was so much room left on this schedule that I used to draw pictures. I had all sorts of pictures with people with flowers and everything else, and all little I had this little rubber cat paw stamp that I would stamp across the face of this thing, just to fill up the space because the page was empty. Now, nowadays you don't have schedules, you have perk charts and, I mean, all kinds of charts, cover walls. And so you can't have the continuity of spirit nowadays that you used to because it's just so much more involved. Back then you were the engineer, technician, floor sweeper, solderer, everything.
Well, so Tom, you're saying that's one of the points that I don't know, the model I had to follow because I came from Raytheon, so I didn't have any background with manufacturing whatsoever. I sat in an engineering group.
Yeah.
Never saw a manufacturing floor. When you came here, and I worked on the PDP-8s and the 8i, manufacturing was down in the basement. Well, floor one, there is a sub-basement under that. And you expected to be down on the line if there was a problem. sit there.
Ken, the philosophy at that time, that you really didn't want manufacturing engineers in manufacturing, because if the engineers couldn't design it right, they'd go out and work on it until they got it working, and therefore they weren't free to design another product.
Yeah, it's a deliberately self-serving thing. Yeah, now,
he said, and it keeps them out of mischief designing another product if they can't, if you can't get this one going, that's a good thing.
And the first PDP-11s were built on the top floor of Building 1. And we actually had the idea of a prototype line, and then we transferred it out. Then the next machines, we got into the philosophy that we would build directly on the floor in manufacturing. And that was a unique situation because Roger Cady at that point in time decided to go off and work for Jack Smith on Westminster.
Yeah, we all took off for Westminster, but we transferred the line from 1-5 to Ronnie and the guys in Westfield.
The 20 did go out to Westfield, and it wasn't necessary for the engineering group to go there. On the 40, though, part of the engineering group
we went out to
transferred to Westfield. We're sort of the design engineers, the new product startup engineers, and the manufacturing engineers.
You, me, Brzezinski, Molus, Barry, we all went to 40.
Yeah,
did John go? John, you didn't go, did you, when we went to Westminster?
Yeah.
We all sat.
I think Jansen was out there for a little while too.
Huh?
I think Paul was out there for a little while.
No, Paul wasn't. It was Molus, myself, Barry, you, and John.
Now, another delight there was that Roger Cady, who was the engineering manager, was also the floor manager. So, therefore, arguments between the floor and the engineering group didn't go very far. And there weren't many arguments because you were sitting on the floor. And so, therefore, you wrote all your ECOs to be effective on day one of the next month or day one of the next quarter. You never got in the way of trying to introduce an ECO the last day of the quarter.
Revenue.
Right? So would you suggest that cross-functional involvement was perhaps one of the key success factors of the early 11s?
I say that from where I was sitting.
Okay, by that time you left the firm entrenched. That was not real
early. In the early stages, we put production people with engineering, and they built machines.
I think Andy was very much a catalyst in bringing together, because he used on it basically on a weekly basis. He would bring in manufacturing, engineering, marketing, programming, and merge them together at what he called the steering committee meeting, and that was Hank Spencer. Where's Hank Spencer?
Fuzzy Fish.
Yeah, because he was the software person, and I remember him talking software, and Julius would be talking the numbers.
Right. So Andy had a lot of real involvement of the whole team there.
Andy really played a systems program manager's role there.
Tell me a little bit about the involvement of Ken Olson in the early days in the development.
Arms length.
We did change the switch arms to a toggle on the next set of machines.
Actually, it was just like saying it was kiss of death having him
to be fair, I think Ken was wising up.
Yeah. He stayed
to
away
be honest
on that.
With Ken, I think he was wising up. And realizing that he could away. Cause more damage.
He hasn't been around in 20 years, obviously.
Wait a minute. I think Tom was right because Ken stayed away from us because he was afraid what might happen to us is what happened with the PDPX. There's a lot of bad feeling for the whole company. And he just let the guys in the 11, because I remember him. He was mainly with Neville and I, and Neville's boss, Warren Prentice, in the drafting. Oh, no, what I'm just saying is at that time in the 11, he was more interested in the 8s, and he used to just show up in the mechanical stuff.
I think Roger used to detract him with things.
Yeah. You know, something that would intrigue Ken, like switches or something that. Well, yeah, because I remember Ken writing memos about he went to Sears and went through and the switches that Sears used in their washing machines or something like that. Oh, cost 12 cents and...
How come we're spending 18?
Remember we got into automotive connectors on the power supplies? That was one of the things that came out of Ken.
But I think Ken was kind of... I think Roger, in a sense, really tried to keep him...
Occupied
him and let Ken do little things that wouldn't screw up the design.
The only thing I remember him getting involved in is when Chuck and I were making models of either a 5-inch or a 10.5-inch machine, and
once we made a decision to go with the bigger unit, he seemed to leave everything alone. But he was reasonably satisfied that we had.
I think the 11 was run the way Ken wanted it to be run, as a very open operation. Did anyone ever get told that you shouldn't tell somebody something about the PDP-11? But the PDP-X was run like a top secret project. There were big fat walls around it, and you were either inside or outside. And that was one of the things I think led to its problems, is that it was kept a secret.
Anybody before they go wants to take a peek, I have an old 1973, I think, article here by Roger Cady about how he ran his engineering group.
What's the word?
It basically says, this open
guide your engineers to self-rule.
Let them do their own thing and stay out of their way. Keep them out from doing, worrying about budgets and schedules and operational sort of things. Let them concentrate on technology.
Well, Roger also at one point mentioned the fact he very carefully had his office. He had the copier machine and the coffee pot outside of his office.
That's right.
Which meant that he'd find out an awful lot about what was going on.
Well, he also had Ellen outside of his office, and that was more important than anything.
For some of us.
Signal guys, as married guys, it made no difference.
Yeah, she told him everything. I mean, she got all the dirt and passed it on to him.
I have to think most of us married guys would use corporate brass Ellen, too.
Yeah.
Great.
What was the PDP-X that you were referring to?
That was what became the Nova, the Data Journal.
Uh-huh, okay.
And there was a bunch of reasons why that didn't happen, but I think John hit it on the head, because Jim was doing eight supports. I was working with Mel Arsenault, and we were supposed to be working for Sogi and DeCastro and all, and we never knew what the hell was going on in that program when we were the technicians on it.
Take
Mumble, 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 remember?
And, I really liked him.
Yeah, brilliant guy, but, they kept things close to their vest, and in the 11, you always knew what was going on. Most of the schedules were posted there. We knew where we were. We were on 1-2, and we had the Jim's rat's nest there, and, I mean, it was ugly. And all of the benches were on there, and then Tom had his disc stuff right next to it, and if anything, that was even more worse, right?
And well, I had an image to uphold, you know?
Yeah.
What were some of the practical jokes you pulled on each other during the course of the design and implementation?
I remember one time people were worried about customers plugging in third-party disks into our controllers. As it turns out, we had an additional line built into our disk drives that nobody knew about, and so I put on a demonstration one day for Katie and Knowles, I think it was, out in the lab. And it was supposed to be funny. They didn't laugh. What I did was I showed them that if you plug in a foreign disk into the cable, this one unused signal line was dragged to ground, which I had hooked up to a transistor, which saturated with a low resistance resistor to power, and it burned. So the whole idea was plug in a foreign disk and smoke start pouring out of it. I did it out in the lab, and I thought it was hilarious. And they screamed. They screamed bloody murder.
Now, in terms of smoke, there was one situation on the power supply. Because power failed on the PDP-8i, it caused me a lot of anguish. It was on a flip chip, and I had to solve getting it to work. It was a discrete circuit. Finally, a capacitor resistor worked, because that was about all there was room for it. But I sat down there for almost a week, most days and evenings, very concerned about power fail and the PDP-11 working. So Andy Verostek and I think you must have got the cams, Chuck. We set up relays that were cam-driven, and therefore their opening and closing was unpredictable, especially after you connected four or five of them in series and parallel. And these were put on the AC line into the PDP 1120 power supply, the H720. And so you had these waveforms of AC power coming into the unit. And power fail didn't work, and then I go home, design something. And Andy was great. Andy used to work nights, and he'd try out what I was doing. Oh, we used to work three shifts.
Which Andy?
Andy Bostick. And, you know, I'd come in the next morning with the next idea, you know, and get put in during the day usually, and Andy would test it that night. So we used to work through an idea a day almost. And finally we got to where we really felt it was working because the cams blew the transformer in the machine. We were putting in so much high frequency signals from the AC line that it just the transformer just gave out. At that point in time, we figured the power fail was working. And that circuit was used without change in the next machine.
We can blame you then for the rise of power supply engineering here at Tech then.
We have a power supply design group here.
Yeah. It has slowly evaporated.
So you wouldn't do it anymore.
I thought Barry got out of that job.
Tell me what the first P2P11s were used for, and how did you all know what the system needed to do as you were developing it and as they were first coming off the line and becoming popular? Were they all used for, like, process control or...
One of my favorite trips to Europe was to go to Zurich for a week to teach the Swiss telephone company, PPT, I think it's called, how to interface to the Unibus. And they had eight engineers who spoke German and understood but couldn't speak English. I could speak English but couldn't understand German at all. That was very interesting, and they built a lot of interfaces to control their whole system.
The general feeling was there was very little, if at all, business-type applications as we know them today. They were more the scientific applications, the real-time applications. We sold them to engineers. We didn't sell them to MIS people. We had no applications to sell per se, and we were selling instruction set. We were selling timing. We were selling the neat bus, a single bus. The fact that peripherals could come on and come off the bus, no big problem.
The expandability.
The expandability issue. The fact that this is the start of a family. Our goal was to have a family, plug in new processors, same peripheral type of thing. I remember making many customer visits when they were talking about, well, how fast was this instruction? And you used to go through this, blah, 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 like this. Oh, wow, you know, hey, I'm going to buy one kind of thing. And you impressed that part of the marketplace, and that was the marketplace that was buying them. And then the OEM marketplace was buying them because they had a job to do. Their job was to go and create the application. And they used our computers that were easier than other people's to interface to develop the software on and around.
The market was what we call sophisticated end users, but the real definition of them was eager and not too fussy.
Yeah. The guy who could help me is Bobby Nero.
They valued the same things we value.
He was one of the main marketing guys, and he did a lot of the stuff.
They were really technology-hungry companies.
Yeah. But they were just like us, technology-hungry. Yeah. And I think that's something that...
Yeah, one of the uses I remember that somebody got the 11 and automated the bar.
Yeah, yes. I went to that bar to
and
check
all
it out.
The liquor things were on there. You know, an ounce would come out.
That was
and would bring it up in the register so that way the guy couldn't put the quarters in his mouth. Okay? But it was a totally automated bar system. It would tell them when, and it worked so you got 30 shots out of a 32 ounce bottle. Okay, and it would be registered on one of the papers, and then the way the owner would check it, he'd check the cash register against this, and he knew exactly what was going on. But that was one of the first ones I remember.
And the reason that it failed was because part of the ambiance of a bar is that extra little slop when the guy holds the jigger over the thing, and a little of it slops over into the glass, and you think you're getting a little something extra. And, of course, that can't happen in this case. And it just took away all the ambiance.
Where was that? Was that local?
That was in the Prudential.
Yeah, Prudential. And the other
they had a bar called something or other down at the bottom of the Prudential.
Yeah. And then was the other one was they hooked the 11s to the, that was the first time they tried it on the milling machines and lathes. Those were the forerunners to
the computer-aided machinery that they got, but that was the first time they started doing it.
I remember programming the Baron's Punch Press.
But I think it shows that nobody really had a preconceived notion about what we're going to do with these machines. I mean, we called ourselves an engineering-driven company. That was because whatever we could design, someone would figure out how to use it. And we didn't look for particular customers and try and fill a market requirement. We just put together whatever we thought was great, and someone would buy it. Those days are gone.
The other point was that we didn't need someone to interpret what the customer wanted.
Because we didn't care.
No. He was us.
But we also had a kind of a left-hand switch in there. We had, for a while there, it was decided that we would not let the 8, would not let the 11 impinge on the 8. So there was pressure on the 11 to go off and find a business different than what the 8 was doing, because there wasn't a certain group of people that wanted to move right in on top of the 8 business, and they said, no, don't do that. So we protected the 8 business for several years and really pushed the 11 into new fields.
Where was the 8 being used? Well, that was the first risk machine.
It was doing some typesetting, it was doing instrument control.
A lot of university applications for schools.
Is there any justification for the 11 or the 20 going into the first machine?
Any justification?
Why was it the PDP 11? Why not the...
We needed a 16-bit machine.
What's 11 got to do with the 16-bit machine?
It was the next machine.
So why was it the 1120, not the 1190?
It was the 11. It wasn't the 20. It was the 11.
I was going to ask you that. I've got one of the old PDP 11 face panels.
That's right.
Only the 11.
Rose and magenta, not magenta and rose.
How many were there? How many went out as 11?
Dark purple.
No, it was rose and magenta, and then we switched to magenta and rose. But the reason we got the 20 is Jimmy was doing the second machine, and Steve, what was his name?
Tyka
was doing the little one. So the little one was in a 5-inch box, so we call that the 05. Ken wanted a smaller one. We called it the 03. We put it in 3.5 inches, and we had to have names for the other two. So we just said the 20 was in the middle, and Jim was the 15, and then we'd go up and down.
Well, the 15 was the OEM of the 20.
That's right, and we also had a problem. We were going to call it the 1100, but IBM had a machine, or somebody had a machine, Univac had a machine.
I think that was some other problem.
Originally it was going to be 1100, and we decided then just go up.
Okay, but then another problem that occurred later on was the 1140 was supposed to be the 1130. And I happen to have one of those face panels, but Bill Johnson, Ted Johnson, saw that name and said, no, IBM has an 1130.
Yeah.
So we jumped over 1130, we did a 40, and then the OEM version back to 35.
Yeah, because the original business plan that Roger and them guys put together was there was a bunch of 11s that would go up, and they also mentioned in the original business plan the backs. They didn't call it. They said going from a 16-bit to a 32-bit machine. And they called out a total of 11 machines. I think there was like 18 machines designed as 11s before the first backs.
So it sounds like the name actually ended up being driven off of the 1105?
We had the PDP 11 because we had the 8. And you see, remember the 8s then became the 8A, the 8E, and all the rest. So they were using the alphabet, we decided to use the numbers.
And also,
it was that simple.
The reason I think we went the 11, Andy was pushing for a cheaper machine. And so that we wanted to be able to turn around and draw a delineation when we came out with the cheaper machine.
Cheaper than
1120.
The
1105 was cheaper than the 1120.
The
1105 was a little bit slower, or wasn't as fast.
The first
they wanted a lower numbering system.
Thinking about numbers, I know they picked 20, so there was both numbers below it and above it. Yeah. Remember, that was a conscious decision.
Now, the thing about the PDP 11 was that I think the number was taken out while we were working on the DCM.
Yes.
And consequently, when we spent a year on the DCM and threw it away, and then had to go and develop a new machine that took another year, it turns out that the 12 shipped. Yeah, the PDP 12 shipped before the PDP 11. I think so too.
Oh, the 9 did. The 15 was a successful.
Was the 9? Was the 9 a
7400? And then the 9i was named the 15.
The 9 was a speed up 7.
Yes.
All right, but was the 9 a transistor machine or an IC machine?
IC.
So the 15 was the first. So we then were, after the 8i, we were the next.
Yeah.
We were the next IC machine.
That's right.
Linnea, in fact, was the engineering manager of the 9 at one point.
No, that was Jerry Palmer.
Where is he now?
At one point, he was the engineer.
Yeah, he was the engineer.
Don Linnea?
Yeah.
He's in Andover. He works in the same group I do. In terms of ICs, I was looking through the printset, and one of the things Dick Best was attempting to do at the time we did the PDP 11 was something I think that was done on the previous machines. And that is, the previous machines were made with discrete transistors. And there were very limited number of discrete transistors. 3009 sticks in my mind an awful lot as the NPN transistor of choice. Yeah, the R and S series. And within the PDP 11, Dick, I think, was attempting to limit the number of ICs we would buy also. So therefore, there were NAND gates, there were no AND gates. And I believe there were only three complex, and I use parentheses, complex in a very trivial way. There were only three complex ICs in that machine. One was a shift register. One was an adder, not an allo, but an adder. And the third one was a decoder to get the machine states off of the shift register. And that was it. The rest of them were basic NAND type of gates.
It didn't last long.
The flip-flops, I believe there were two flip-flops within one package. But we didn't even have registers then.
That's because you were too lazy to take up the numbers.
Dick was sitting on it.
But all of your other machines afterwards, you always boasted, I'm not going to bring in any new ICs because I don't want to write the specs.
That's right.
You always said that.
Yes.
You always designed that way when you were doing the PDQ. Okay?
I'm getting personal now.
Remember? You were bragging about it. I don't want to bring any more in. That was the way he designed all the time. Use what you had in
mind.
Yeah.
He needed this.
At the time, though.
No, don't get defensive.
I'm not.
Don't mind it.
It wasn't a question of whether I wanted to or not. You were told not to.
But you never listened anyway, Jim.
Yeah. Why'd you listen?
Sure.
No, Dick, that was fun times. Although it was a boundary. Prior to that, if you wanted to get a number for your design, your module, you used to take your design up to Dick's office and do a chalkboard discussion. And this was when they were discrete circuits, and you would draw, you know, your driver, PDP8i drivers, which were -3 volt bus to +3 volt bus. You draw it on the board and explain it, go through the characteristics of the circuit, and Dick would feel comfortable with that. He'd give you, you know, the M something module number, and you wander off and start your design and layout. When you got to the dedicated logic boards, it was much too complicated to do, because what you really were explaining, a sixth of the machine. So at that point in time, I don't know if Dick kept on asking designers to explain their designs, or at that point in time, he felt comfortable with certain designers and let them do what they wanted.
No, he shifted us off to Roger Dow.
Oh, yes.
Right. Because one of the things I did on that machine, which was Dick was...
Brilliant talk.
I wouldn't be that kind.
but like, he gave us a whole set of module numbers. So therefore, we ran a series of module numbers.
You did. You got all these stuff done.
I think we also got design review more.
Yes.
Currently inside the organization.
Yeah, we started when we did the 8L, and then that was the first, and then the 11s, we really started using them a lot.
Now, the other thing we used to do, some people believe that we didn't do, what is that? There's design verification, and then what's the other one that manufacturing was doing?
DVT.
Oh, we never did any of them.
Oh, yes, we did. I maintain we always did. We did it at the customer site.
The deal was, being in that end of the business, is the engineers, when they, in those days, when they did their bench test, essentially did what we folks in quality had to end up doing as DVT and all. You really did check out your own designs. The problem became later on is the engineers just were spitting out the designs, never having any time to check them.
In fact, the 11 was just about the time when we got an honest to good chamber.
That's
temperature
right.
chamber in the company. I remember going up with the PDP-8i to act environmental test.
That's right.
And I think it's Mel Arsenal.
And myself.
Freezing
yeah.
his hand off, putting the dry ice into their chamber.
Yes.
I mean, the poor guy came back and blew me in, you know.
And the other thing we did with the 11 was it was the first one that got the UL approval. Because we never went for agencies until the 11s and the 80s. Those two got it together.
Spent some time in the heat chamber downstairs at 137 degrees aft in my skivvies, just about trying to find an intermittent shot. If you moved, there was enough airflow to make the thing go away, you know.
At least it was better. At least the chamber was a little bit better than the...